All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're taking a look at a case that I think just about any lawyer is going to run into at some point, particularly if you're dealing with property or family law, and that's Fall v. Easton from 1909.
Oh yeah, this is one of those cases that really kind of lays out some of the big questions in American law, especially when you start thinking about states' rights.
You know, it really gets down to the core of how our court systems work across state lines. Like, if you get a divorce decree in one state, can it just automatically transfer property that's located in a completely different state? I mean, that's a huge practical issue that any lawyer who's dealing with multi-state clients is going to have to think about.
And not just any lawyer. I think it's something even law students should wrap their heads around. You know, it's not always as simple as one court order, especially with property.
Right. So today we're going to dive into Fall v. Easton and really unpack how this case kind of throws a wrench in the whole idea of, just assuming a court order in one state is going to perfectly apply in another. But before we get too deep into the weeds, I think it would be helpful to kind of set the stage, introduce the key players and see where this legal drama all started.
Yeah. A little backstory is definitely in order. It helps to understand just how messy things can get when property and divorce and different state laws all come crashing together.
Exactly. So in Fall v. Easton, we start off with a couple, E.W. Fall and his wife. Now, during their marriage, they acquired some land in Nebraska. Simple enough, right? But then things get a little more complicated. The couple decides to pack up and move to Washington State.
Interstate moves.
Yeah.
Always a recipe for some potential legal headaches.
Yeah. Right. Now, fast forward to 1895, and E.W. files for divorce in Washington. But here's where things get interesting. In his divorce filing, he claims that the land back in Nebraska that they acquired during the marriage, well, he says that's his separate property.
So already we're seeing a conflict brewing. Different states, different laws, and a piece of property that's right smack in the middle of it all. What happened next?
Well, the Washington court, they grant the divorce. But here's the twist. They don't agree with EW about the Nebraska land. They rule that it should go to the wife as her separate property.
Okay, so that right there is a big deal. It kind of sets the stage for this whole jurisdictional showdown that's about to happen.
Exactly. And the Washington court, they weren't just messing around. They wanted to make sure this property transfer actually happened. So they ordered EW to sign a deed formally conveying the Nebraska land to his ex-wife.
You know, at this point, you would think it would be pretty straightforward. Court order, sign the deed, done deal.
You'd think so, right? But that's not how EW saw it. He flat out refused to sign that deed.
Oh boy. Talk about digging your heels in.
Now, the Washington court, they're not just going to let him ignore their order. So they took a pretty bold step. They decided to appoint a commissioner, essentially a representative of the court, to execute that deed on EW's behalf. Like, they were trying to force the issue.
So they're trying to bypass him entirely. I mean, you can see why EW might not be too happy about that. Did he just give up?
Well, if EW was going to give up, this wouldn't be a Supreme Court case, would it? He was determined to keep control of that Nebraska land. So what did he do? He went ahead and executed his own deed for that same land, and he gave it to a woman named Elizabeth Easton.
Oh, man. Talk about adding fuel to the fire. Now, if you got a third party involved, this is getting complicated.
Right. So now you have the ex-wife holding a deed granted by the Washington court, and Elizabeth Easton with a separate deed directly from EW. Talk about a recipe for a legal battle. And that's exactly what happened. The ex-wife, she was not going to back down. She filed a lawsuit in Nebraska, Nebraska, where the land was actually located, and she was trying to quiet the title. Essentially, she was asking the Nebraska court to step in, declare her the rightful owner, and throw out that deed EW gave to Elizabeth Easton.
So it finally shifts over to Nebraska's courts. I mean, it makes sense. Property law is usually governed by the state where the property is. So what did the Nebraska courts do?
Well, initially, the trial court in Nebraska sided with the ex-wife. They said, yep, you're the rightful owner. Seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, but I'm guessing that's not the end of the story. If it was, we probably wouldn't be talking about this case a century later.
You got it. It went up on appeal, and the Nebraska Supreme Court, they actually reversed the trial court's decision. They sided with Easton, essentially saying the Washington court's order didn't hold water in Nebraska.
Oh, wow. So now we've got conflicting court rulings. This thing is going all the way to the top, isn't it?
Straight to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the big question became, Does the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution force Nebraska to recognize that Washington State divorce decree and the commissioner's deed as a legitimate transfer of that Nebraska land?
So really, it's all boiling down to this. Can a court in one state just reach across state lines and dictate who owns a piece of property in another state? I mean, that's a huge question about the limits of state power.
It is, and it's a tough one, right? On the one hand, you've got this idea of states respecting each other's court judgments. You know, that's what the full faith and credit clause is all about. It's supposed to make sure our legal system works smoothly across the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this other side of the coin.
The idea that one state could just overrule another state's laws and control property within its borders.
Yeah,
that doesn't sit well with the whole idea of states' rights.
Right. So how do you balance those two things? How do you ensure states cooperate while also protecting their autonomy? That's the tightrope the Supreme Court had to walk in Fall v. Easton.
Yeah, it's a real constitutional puzzle. So what did they decide?
They ended up siding with Nebraska. They said, nope, Washington's court order and that commissioner's deed, they don't automatically transfer the title of that Nebraska land.
So states' rights won out in this case. But what was the legal reasoning behind that? What was the key principle that led them to this decision?
They really leaned on this concept that a state court's power is limited. You know, their jurisdiction generally stops at their state lines, especially when it comes to directly messing with property ownership in another state.
So they're saying even though Washington had a court order, it didn't magically erase Nebraska's authority over land within its own borders.
Exactly. The Supreme Court basically drew this line in the sand saying, look, each state has control over the land within its borders. That's a huge part of American federalism, this idea that states have their own spheres of power. But then it brings up another question, right? If the full faith and credit clause is supposed to make states respect each other's court rulings, why didn't it apply here? Why didn't Nebraska have to just accept what the Washington court decided?
Yeah, that's a good point. It seems like there's a bit of a contradiction there.
Well, the Supreme Court, they kind of addressed that. They made this distinction between a court having personal jurisdiction over a person and having what they call in rem jurisdiction over a specific piece of property.
Okay, so let's break that down. I mean, these legal terms can be a bit confusing. What's the difference between personal jurisdiction and this in rem jurisdiction?
So person jurisdiction basically means a court can tell a specific person what to do. Like they can order them to do something or not do something. You know, they have power over that individual. But in rem jurisdiction is different. That's about a court's power over a specific thing, usually a piece of property.
I see. So in Fall v. Easton, the Washington court, they definitely had personal jurisdiction over E.W. Fall, right? They could order him around. But did they have this in rem jurisdiction over the Nebraska land?
That's where things get tricky. The Supreme Court, they basically said no. They said land is really tied to the state where it's physically located. That means only Nebraska courts have the real power, the in rem jurisdiction, to decide who owns that Nebraska land.
So the Washington court could tell EW to sign a deed, but they couldn't just magically change the ownership of the land in Nebraska.
Right. The Supreme Court was basically saying, Washington, you can order EW all you want, but when it comes to directly affecting that Nebraska land, you're out of bounds.
So their power stopped at the state line, so to speak. So that commissioner's deed, the one the Washington court tried to enforce, why exactly was that no good in Nebraska? Like, what was the legal problem with it?
Well, the Supreme Court, they said it was because the commissioner's deed was trying to do something that Washington courts just didn't have the power to do. It was trying to directly transfer the title of land in another state. And that goes against this whole idea of in rem jurisdiction.
Right, because only the state where the property is located can actually mess with the title of that property.
Mm.
So even though the Washington court tried to get around EW's refusal by appointing a commissioner, Nebraska didn't have to recognize that deed as legally valid.
Exactly. And that brings us back to the full faith and credit clause. It's not that it just disappeared in this case. It's more like there's this built-in limitation.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So the full faith and credit clause, it works when courts are acting within their proper boundaries.
Yeah.
But it can't be used to let one state overreach and control things in another state that they don't have authority over.
Yeah, exactly. It's about making sure states respect each other's authority, but not letting them step on each other's toes when it comes to things like property rights that are so closely tied to a specific state.
Right, because if any state court could just reach into another state and dictate property ownership, it would just be chaos. That wouldn't be respecting states' rights at all.
Exactly. So in this case, Nebraska, they were well within their rights to say, no, we're not going to recognize that commissioner's deed as a legitimate transfer of title. It was a Washington court overstepping its bounds, trying to act on land that it didn't have the authority to directly control. Now, there's another interesting wrinkle in this whole case. It has to do with Justice Holmes and his concurring opinion.
Oh, yeah. Holmes always has to put his own spin on things, doesn't he? Or a little bit different.
Right. And in Fall v. Easton, he agreed with the outcome, you know, that Nebraska didn't have to recognize that deed, but he had a slightly different way of getting there. He focused more on the personal obligation that the Washington court put on E.W. Fall.
Okay, so remind me, what exactly was E.W. obligated to do?
Well, the Washington court, they ordered him to sign that deed, giving the Nebraska land to his ex-wife. So Holmes, he was saying, look, even if Nebraska doesn't recognize the deed itself, they could still enforce that personal obligation that EW had to sign it over.
So Holmes was basically saying, Nebraska, you're not required to treat the Washington court order and the commissioner's deed as if it automatically changed the ownership of the land. But you could still hold EW accountable to follow through on what the Washington court told him to do.
Exactly. He was making this distinction between recognizing the Washington court's action as directly changing the property title, which Nebraska didn't have to do, and enforcing the personal obligation they placed on EW, which he felt Nebraska had the option to do.
So even though he reached the same conclusion as the majority, he was looking at it through a slightly different lens, you know, focusing more on the personal obligations involved rather than just the property itself. It's interesting how, even when justices agree on the outcome, they can have different legal reasoning.
It's a really good point, and it goes to show that even seemingly straightforward cases like this can have these layers of complexity, you know, these different ways of looking at the same legal problem.
Right. And for law students, you know, for anyone really getting into law, it's important to see how those different perspectives play out. It helps you understand the nuances of the law and how it actually works in practice.
So now that we've really dissected Fall v. Easton, what are the big takeaways for law students? What should they be keeping in mind, especially if they're going to be dealing with cases that involve property in different states?
Well, I think the biggest lesson here is that you can't just assume a court order in one state will automatically be effective in another, especially when you're talking about real estate. The physical location of the property really matters.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just about who the court has power over, it's also about where that power reaches.
So, in a practical sense, what should lawyers actually do in situations like this? Like, if you've got a client who's going through a divorce in one state and there's property involved in another state, what steps should they take?
Well, you definitely can't just rely on the court in the divorce state to sort everything out. I mean, that's what got EW's ex-wife into trouble in this case, right? She was relying on that Washington deed.
Right. She thought that was enough.
Yeah. And it turned out to be a big problem. So to avoid that kind of mess, you really need to take action in the state where that property is. Like if you're dealing with land in Nebraska, you need to get a Nebraska court involved to enforce the divorce decree or whatever other order needs to happen regarding that property.
So it's not enough to just get an order in one state. You have to actually go to the state where the property is and get their courts to recognize and enforce that order.
Exactly. It might seem like a hassle, but trust me, it's way less of a headache than trying to untangle a property dispute across state lines after the fact. Because if you don't, you could end up with a situation like in Fall v. Easton, where someone else swoops in, buys the property, and then you've got a real legal nightmare on your hands.
So to sum it all up, Fall v. Easton really boils down to this idea that courts have limits on their power. They can tell people what to do, but they can't just reach across state lines and directly change property ownership. Each state has its own sovereignty over the land within its borders, and that's something that every lawyer needs to understand, especially when dealing with multi-state issues.
Absolutely. This case isn't just some dusty old legal precedent. It's a really important principle that lawyers deal with every day. And the Supreme Court made it crystal clear in Fall v. Easton just how important those state lines are.
Well, on that note, I think we've given everyone a lot to think about. But before we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought. You know, this case dealt with physical property, like land, something you can see and touch. But what about the digital world?
Oh, that's interesting, like crypto or NFTs.
Exactly. Those things don't exist in a specific physical location. So how do these principles of jurisdiction and states' rights, how do they apply in the digital age? Something to think about. And that's it for today's deep dive into Fall v. Easton. We'll see you next time.
Until then, keep on learning.